This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Hetty McKinnon, and welcome to The Kitchen Table on The History Listen, where for the next few weeks, I'll be opening the pantry and tasting the past. As a food lover and cookbook writer, I'm always intensely curious about my ingredients, so this journey, for me, is one of pure delight. Today, we kick off with an often overlooked and unsung beverage, but one that's played a huge role in the Australian pantry and throughout history. Tea. Tea conjures family memories.
When I was around 10 or 11, my grandmother decided that I was old enough that I could make a pot of tea. I took it over to her and started to pour it, and she said I hadn't done it properly. And what I hadn't done was turn the teapot anti-clockwise three times.
Tea has its experts.
Caffeine in tea is most concentrated in the tip, in the bud and the two leaves. And some tea blenders are interested only in the tip, chasing very tippy teas, bit of a hit with the tip.
And tea also has a very Australian angle.
It was so adapted here. So, you know, Waltzing Matilda, what's the first thing the swag man does is sets his billy to boil, and no one says he's sitting down for a cup of tea, but I think we all assume that that's what he's making.
But before the swaggy even got hold of the tin to fashion his billy, Australia's tea drinking obsession was well underway. Historian Jackie Newling, geographer Peter Griggs, and tea grower Stephen Bright are our guides today. So put the kettle on, make sure you have a teapot that will turn, and let's find out just what got us brewing.
There once was a ship that put to sea, and the name of that ship was the Billy of Tea.
Tea, by the late 18th century in England, had become entrenched across all classes. The daily ritual in many households was to have several cups of tea. Even convicts who came to Australia had a taste for tea.
When the first fleet arrived in 1788, the officers bought their own tea, but tea wasn't part of the rations that were allocated to the convicts.
Soon may the wellerman come to bring us sugar and tea and rum. One day when the tonguing is done, we'll take our leave and go.
The Aborigines showed the convicts a tea substitute from the Smilax vine. It's known as wild sarsaparilla.
It took on the name sweet tea. It's vaguely licorice, sort of fennel taste, but it also has quite a strong saccharine taste. And, of course, sugar wasn't in their rations either, so it ticked both boxes for them.
But it led to some of the first conflict between Europeans and Aborigines in Australia, because the convicts basically cleared out Sydney Cove of all of this creeper to make a tea substitute, which upset the Aborigines.
We know that the native sarsaparilla was a medicinal herb plant for Aboriginal people, quite slow growing, but also the diarists say that they had to go further and further afield to gather sweet tea. So that sent colonisers into Aboriginal country outside the settlement boundary, which of course would have been just an encroachment on their land.
At the time, Chinese tea and other supplies came to the new colony via England. But as soon as direct shipping routes were established, the convicts were let in on the action.
By 1820, tea had been included as part of the convict rations.
The fact that it did enter the rations in the 1820s sort of shows you how embedded it had become as an essential product as opposed to a luxury. Hyson tea was a green tea from China, and that was what the convicts got. That was one of the cheapest teas. And there's a lovely old treatise written in 1785 that said the Hyson tea was quite a good tea, but it could take many waters, which gives you that idea that it was quite strong. And so, therefore, you only needed to offer a convict or your staff, you know, your servants, a small amount.
Tea starts to be used as currency. Rural workers start to get paid in tea, flour and sugar. So that starts the very high levels of tea consumption in Australia.
It's quite an important story about commerce and trade and power. So the tea was grown and processed in China. The British East India Company had exclusive import rights.
The British East India Company was on a roll. England and Europe were enchanted by the heady brew, and we followed suit. But China's world monopoly on the production of tea was making England nervous. Tea grower Stephen Bright.
England was buying tea from China, but it had nothing to sell. And then eventually it discovered what it could sell to China, which was probably a blight on its history. It grew opium in South India and sold opium to China in exchange for tea. And so therefore it had a desire to replace that supply with its own source of tea, and hence the plan was to establish tea in India, which was part of the colonial empire at that point.
The plan was hatched in 1848. Scottish botanist Robert Fortune was sent on a spy mission to China. He became famous, returning with 20,000 Chinese tea plants. He headed to the foothills of India's Himalayas, Assam. The trade tables were about to turn.
So it was Chinese tea that people were drinking, probably right up to the sort of 1860s or so, when the Indian-grown tea became the strong source of tea for the empire. It's very much a story of empire, exploiting poorer countries and agricultural environments for the benefit of people in far-flung countries who were willing to actually pay a lot of money, so there was a lot of profit in it.
And it wasn't long before someone spied an opportunity down south.
If you listen very carefully, I'll tell you a tale of coffee and tea. And
in 1880, a gentleman called James Inglis comes to Australia, and his brother was president of the Calcutta Chamber of Commerce. James Inglis was very entrepreneurial, and he talks to his brother and says, look, there's a huge market for tea in Australia.
Then down around the dreaded port, where ships were lost and legends born, laden with precious coffee.
And you'll be able to get Indian tea into Australia. And so James Inglis single-handedly starts a campaign to oust Chinese tea from the Australian market.
Southern Sea, countless circular keys.
Rumours started spreading through Sydney town about dodgy Chinese tea. In some circles, it came to be known as slow poison. Probably a bit unfair. They were accused of
adulterating the tea that they sent to the Australian colonies by putting in used tea leaves, iron filings, Prussian blue, which is sort of a copper sulphate-based product.
And it was one of the fastest switches of taste in the history of eating and drinking. Australia's sudden preference for teas from India and Ceylon.
We started to see depictions of tea pickers, turbaned, bare-chested tea pickers, picturing that place of origin so explicitly.
Was seen as British tea, part of the empire, supporting the empire. Australians very quickly abandoned Chinese tea imports.
The best tea was now associated with Ceylon and Assam, in India's high country, a region that held a special place in the heart of one of Australia's first major tea cultivators.
His name was Michael Grant Cook. He was a Brit. Background was Sri Lankan and Indian. His dream was to grow subtropical tea south of the equator.
Stephen Bright has now taken over Grant Cook's tea estate in northern New South Wales.
So he found this spot and he named it Madura, which is Tamil for place of peace or paradise. Effectively, we mirror Assam in northeast India. Cool, short, sharp winters, warm summers, rain, and cool nights. The seeds that were planted here came from Ceylon and India. Yep, we just jumped in the little golf buggy to do a bit of a run round the estate. The reality in Australia is cost of labour, so you have to be clever about what you do to still provide work opportunities, but work within the ambit of what the rest of the world allows you to do. the tea game has become a global game where packers of tea just chase wherever they can establish a low-cost environment.
Ceylon tea was always the top quality. It demanded a higher price. So if you were from the upper classes in Australia, you tended to want to have tea from Ceylon being served in your house.
Whether it's out in your garden, afternoon tea under the bowers, or whether it's in your refined drawing room with the fire on, it was a way of sharing your space as well as your time and as well as your tastes. Bit of theatre, I suppose, where the lady of the household could sort of show off her finery and her particular blend of tea and talk about her favourite or this one or where it's just come from. So sort of express their sort of worldliness. Where's this one come from?
So this one is coming from Sri Lanka, blended or packed and consolidated in Sri Lanka to our requirements. It allows us to blend that to our other teas that we will introduce with that, because traditionally English breakfast teas were a combination of Sri Lankan and Indian teas. Irish breakfast is 100%, traditionally 100% Indian tea.
But nearly a century before Stephen Bright's predecessor was growing and blending tea leaves in northern New South Wales, tea was one of our largest imports.
Say around 1885, the average tea consumption for an adult in Western Australia and Queensland was around 54 to 56 kilograms or 100 pounds a year. And that's obviously because Western Australia and Queensland were the two warmest colonies and where physical activity required the workers to drink a lot of fluid.
There's a poem saying we lived on mutton, tea and damper. You know, that's that sort of swagman's diet. So you can have your flour sack and your caddy of tea, and that was enough to set you up.
Masters often gave their workers more tea than the standard ration, because if they were drinking tea, they weren't drinking rum or other forms of alcohol. So it was also linked to trying to stop drunkenness amongst workers.
You can talk of your whiskey and talk of your beer.
James Inglis becomes a tea trader.
But there's something much nicer that's waiting us here.
And by 1890, he has developed Billy Tea, which is the famous brand.
It sits by the fire beneath the gum tree. There's nothing quite like it, a Billy of tea.
Once a jolly swagman kept at the Billy Bar.
James Inglis was shopping for a clever way to market Billy Tea and chanced upon Waltzing Matilda, which could, with a bit of tweaking, carry the message. And James Inglis somehow contrived to have Marie Cohen, you know, write the music, and they changed one of the lines to directly reference Billy Tea.
And he sang as he watched and waited till his Billy boiled.
The thing that stands out about Australian consumption of tea is the development and use of Billy, that quintessential Australian piece of equipment, the Billy, out in the bush boiling tea.
A lot of Australians embrace that song as their unofficial national anthem, unbeknownst to them. It's one of the first examples of product placement in Australia.
And so Billy tea or tea drinking was part of the outdoor experience of even urban-based Australians.
There's nothing quite like it, a Billy tea.
Picnics had just been invented. Now, I know it sounds odd that picnics had just been invented, but they had just been invented. Picnics were more than just eating out of doors. It was a more carefree way of eating without all the hierarchy that went round sitting at a table, relaxed and casual. And this new thing called the picnic, because of the Australian climate, it was very quickly continued and progressed, which is why we have places called Picnic Point and so on. And the Billy Tea goes with the bush picnic.
I don't touch the grub, though so hungry I be. I wait till it's ready, my Billy tea. You can talk of your whiskey.
I have some wonderful photographs in my research of Australians having bush picnics. And I got the magnifying glass and I looked very carefully and I'm thinking, they have taken their china pots and their china teacups and whatever out into the bush to drink their billy tea.
Often you find it's not the tea itself that differentiates the class, it's all the accoutrements that go with it.
I hope you're sipping your tea from a cup with a saucer.
I'm Hetty McKinnon and you're with the History Listen at the kitchen table, tasting our past. On the menu today is tea and how we seem to have developed an insatiable thirst for it. But first, a quick trip back to Stephen Bright's estate.
Let's go and have a look. We start here about 6:30 in the morning. The ideal is to get the tea before too much of the sun has heated the leaf. Leaf coming in from the field comes in this bin, green and fresh, and you can smell that vegetable aroma in the air, dropping the leaf onto a conveyor that's then feeding the machinery down below. So this is yesterday's harvest that's now been withered, now been dropped into the machinery down below for processing. The leaf over further over is what we've harvested today, and that will be processed tomorrow. 30% of the moisture has been taken out. Then at the end of the line, here we have it. A bit like a Granny Smith apple, bright green. If we allow oxygen to affect the tea we've processed, it starts to go brown. And that's how we make black tea.
But in the early 1940s, Stephen Bright's tea plantation was still 30 years away. And the tea consumed by Australians was grown in other countries. When the Second World War started, so did our supply problems. And the Brits were just as thirsty as us.
At the outbreak of World War II, many Australians were drinking 10 to 12 cups of tea a day. The Japanese cut off the supply of tea to Australia. Australia then has to rely very heavily on the goodwill of the Brits.
Our consumption of tea really illustrates or sort of reflects, I suppose, our social makeup. So for a long time, our sort of Anglo-Celtic background is really symbolised in that idea of tea being the national beverage.
And so from February 1942, we have tea rationing.
And that didn't go down too well. But then in some of the cookbooks, you find alternatives to tea that people were saying, make apple teas. It's funny these days, we have lots of fruit teas and herb teas and things. They're quite trendy. Although it wasn't the black tea, they still had to find alternatives faced with rations.
Lovely. It's not everyone who can make a good cup of tea. It's simple, merely. But many people get careless about tea making.
Australians were allowed roughly 3 or 4 ounces of tea a day. 3 ounces of tea is not much more than 2 tea bags max a day. And when you're considering that some Australians were drinking 10 to 12 cups of tea a day, it was quite a shock. And Australians did a number of things to try and improve their tea supply. I went to the National Archives in Canberra and there's a file heading that says tea rationing. So I called that up and the archivist appeared with one trolley load and she said, but that's not it. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, there's 2 more trolley loads of material. Basically, the Curtin government was just inundated with complaints. A driver of a Bushels tea truck pulls over to relieve himself in a public convenience and he comes out and finds that his truck full of tea had been stolen. The pillaging of tea at wharves was very widespread. A truck loaded with chests of bushel tea tips over, the chests of tea all break open and so there's tea all over the road and people start coming out from the nearby houses and shops scooping up the tea, and then people start fighting each other. Essentially a riot broke out and the police had to come to restore order.
When Lipton blows the whistle, you gotta have a
an Italian resident of Fremantle, was able to persuade her local dentist not to charge but to take all her tea vouchers as payment for the tooth extraction.
But at the end of the war, not all tea drinkers went back to their old habits. Times were changing.
Distance is a thing of the past.
Australia starts to get a lot of post-World War II immigrants.
A giant ship of the air loaded with passengers and mail.
And these immigrants are coming from Europe.
Afternoon tea is served, of course.
We always serve bushel tea on our planes.
A wise man indeed. The world may change, but bushel's tea always remains the same.
Lovely. It's not everyone who can make a good cup of tea.
Picture me up on your knee. Just tea for two and two for tea.
In the decades after the Second World War, our changing social makeup gave rise to the emergence of another kind of drinking culture. Could this be the end of the tea caddy?
Look, coffee was always here and there were coffee houses in the late 1800s, but I think coffee became more accessible because Italians and Greek people, Europeans I should say, made espresso coffee. You needed that equipment to be able to make a properly percolated, palatable coffee.
Let us take you with us to the world of the future, from Sydney to San Francisco, New York to London.
Coffee drinking is modern, it's associated with America, it's trendy. And the final piece of the puzzle is Nestle's, of course, develops instant coffee. You're getting instant coffee late 1950s, early 1960s.
People trying to keep pace with the speed of living created by themselves. Happy modern people.
Suddenly, it's much easier just to put a teaspoonful of coffee into a mug, pour in some hot water. You don't have to go through the cumbersome process of making a pot of tea.
If I stand starry-eyed, that's a danger in paradise.
And that's when you start that sort of competition between the two. Which one would you prefer? They're both as easy to make as the other. If anything, instant coffee was easier because you didn't have all these leaves and strainers and things like that. The tea manufacturers got a little alarmed about that and had to come up with their own sort of instant options.
Bushels totally misread the Australian tea market in the 1960s. Bushels put all their research and development funds into trying to develop a palatable instant tea that would be like Nestle's instant coffee. Australians detested it and they wouldn't buy it.
This is tea.
I do remember trying instant tea at one point, I think it was in the 70s, and I seem to remember it was quite ghastly.
Oh dear, it wasn't looking good. Next step, some modern marketing.
Filling a cup. Not with indigestion. Not with nerves. Not with sleepless nights. This is tea.
The advertisements suddenly become much more colourful.
What do you want from a cup of tea? Relaxation? Real lift? Drink Kinkara, more cups to the pound.
And there was still one more invention up their sleeves.
You jingle in a cup, you dangle in a pop, the jingle dangle bag lets you do the lot.
And then, of course, the tea industry strikes back with tea bags.
Please taste it and you will see.
The tea bag became the solution.
Agree, that's really splendid tea.
Tea bags arrive in Australia in 1959 and start to replace packet tea.
These are Italian machines producing 450 tea bags a minute. That's 7 tea bags with string, tag and paper made every second, and being counted down in rows of 25. It seems simple, it's paper, but it's actually got to infuse a particular way, allow the tea to go through the paper membrane, pour the boiling water on. The particles of the paper expand at an exponential rate, allowing the tea a flavour, Some manufacturers in the world have over 100 of these machines, but each machine's about $1.8 to $2 million per machine.
Stephen Bright's Madura estate started producing tea in 1978. Initially, it sold only leaf tea, but to stay in the game has had to move with time and tastes.
A group of friends from Sydney had come to see Paris. At first, they thought they'd really like a cup of Lipton tea.
Woolworths themselves said, you need to now produce some tea bag teas, and so it went from there.
Tea consumption in Australia has plateaued since 1990. It's mostly tea bags and herbal tea.
It's no longer about our imperial ties. We see it as an Australian product.
Once a jolly swagman camped by a billabong under the shade of a coolabah tree. He sang and he watched and waited till his
tea was Australia's first real encounter with Asia. That's China and India and Ceylon. So the story of Australia's interaction and trade with Asia initially revolves around tea.
We don't necessarily think of tea as being exotic, but it has always been exotic to the Australian culture and to the English culture before that. And I think it just reminds us of how shaped we are by trade, by global influence, by this sort of trade of taste, if you like. And then we're turning someone else's taste into something that we define as our own.
That jump buck in his tucker bag. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me.
Today's episode of The Kitchen Table was produced by Ros Blewett, with sound design by John Jacobs. Many thanks to geographer Peter Griggs.
How to make a good cup of tea. Turn the teapot 3 times anti-clockwise, and it's all to do with making the hot water move through the tea leaves and extracting the flavour from the tea leaves.
Historian Jackie Newling.
I think a lot of people now, even that use a pot, still use a tea bag in the pot. Because I think the pot side of it is still the ritual, that idea of filling the pot, letting it warm.
Academic Susie Karmas.
It feels like a hug, and so there is something comforting, sometimes even therapeutic, about tea.
And tea maker Stephen Bright.
The rain has stopped and we can reverse out of here and go and have a cup of tea. The best thing about a tea estate.
You've been with The History Listen on Radio National. I'm Hetty McKinnon, looking forward to your company next time when we go digging for the only rock we eat, salt. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.